Next Wednesday is December 7th. The date resonates with generations of Americans, including people who were not yet born in 1941. It was on that date and in that year that Japanese forces on sea and sky attacked the American naval base at Pearl Harbor near Honolulu, Hawaii. 2,400 Americans died that day, nearly half of them on board the USS Arizona. It was one of 18 ships sunk or run aground in the attack. The attack simultaneously crippled our Navy in the Pacific and propelled us into World War II. Craig Nelson writes of the day and what led up to it anew in Pearl Harbor, From Infamy to Greatness. Craig Nelson has been around the book writing block a few times. Rocket Men, shot to the New York Times bestseller list. He's also the author of The Age of Radiance and The First Heroes, among other books. And Craig's shorter work appears in journals ranging from Vanity Fair to Popular Science. Craig Nelson, a pleasure to have you on the Jefferson Exchange. Thanks.
It's always great to be here, Jeff. Thank you so much for having me.
So you hook us right in the preface as we get to meet a sailor from Arizona and get to find out about some mundane procedures aboard the deck of a ship like holy stones. What was that about?
Well, I really enjoyed the fact that, you know, here is something that takes place 75 years ago, and we talk about a period of time where we have the centerpieces of the Navy are dreadnoughts, which was their word, fear nothing for battleships, and holy stoning. All of the decks of those ships were made from teak, and in order to polish them, they put limestone bricks, which they got from many destroyed churches in World War I's Europe, and that's why they called holy stones, and they put them on the end of a broomstick to soothe down the deck of the ship.
Wow.
And I love that phrase.
It is a great phrase, holy stones. James Lawson is an interesting character. How did you fall upon his story?
Well, we were really looking for people who could tell us, bring us back to the pre-Pearl Harbor era. And he was one of many that we found. And I liked him because he got promoted a lot. So you got to hear all about the different jobs aboard a battleship because he got promoted again and again and again. And he sort of was very reflective of that era and that the guys assigned to Hawaii, they were as young as 15 because you could get in at 16, but many people lied, so they got in at 15. They were as young at 15, 16, 17 years old. That was the majority of the sailors in the Navy at that moment. And they're far, far, far from home in Oahu. And, of course, we think of Hawaii as this fantastic tropical vacation. It wasn't for them. They were lonely and sad and took comfort in the gedunk bar. But they were sort of overwhelmed because, you know, each ship would have 11 to 15,000 men serving aboard it, which is quite a bit larger than most of the towns these boys came from.
Did you say gedunk bar?
Right. That was the name for the ice cream bar.
Oh.
So they loved having, you know, the soda fountain era. They loved having soda fountains.
All right. So from James Lawson's time in 1941 on the eve of the Pearl Harbor attack aboard the USS Arizona, we go back in time. Talk about the laying of the keel of the USS Arizona and who was there.
Well, this is one of my favorite discoveries. We came across the fact that in 1914, Franklin Delano Roosevelt was Assistant Secretary of the Navy in the Woodrow Wilson administration, and he came to the Brooklyn Navy Yard in Brooklyn, New York, to watch the official birth of the latest naval great ship, great flagship, what would become the Arizona, although it wasn't called that at the time. It was called Number 39. And you see Roosevelt. It's 7 years before he gets polio and is paralyzed. It's 2 months before Archduke Ferdinand is assassinated, beginning the Great War. And you see him in all of his glory, madly in love with the United States Navy. Roosevelt loved the Navy so much that when he was president, he personally selected all of the flag officers because he knew them all from his time in the service. He raised the Navy's budget every year during the middle of the Depression, and he called the Navy us and the Army them until General Marshall made him cut it out. So you get to see the entire birth of what will become Pearl Harbor at this moment in 1914.
How different, if at all, was the Arizona from the ships of its day?
It was actually a state-of-the-art battleship for its time in 1914. There's one ship I know of exactly like from that lineage, which is the USS Texas, which is moored outside of Houston at the San Jacinto Monument. And actually, they did a fairly good job of recreating what those ships looked like in the Ben Affleck movie. The one problem is that the Navy wasn't quite sure what a battleship paint should be to camouflage it on the ocean. So they kept painting the decks all these different colors over and over again, different kinds of shades of blue, black, and blue, white, and all these different colors to try and match it so it would be camouflage in the Pacific. So it's actually not clear exactly what color these ships were at the time of Pearl Harbor.
Oh, and I guess we were talking about the visibility to aircraft. That's why the decks are being painted?
No, yes, from attacking aircraft.
Okay, got it. So give us a sense of Pearl Harbor and how well developed it was or was not by say 1940.
Well, one of the funny things about this history is that when people try to defend the Navy and say it wasn't their fault and they did nothing wrong, they bring up that the two commanders of Pearl Harbor complained over and over again that they didn't have the men and equipment that they needed for such a base. Well, in fact, Pearl Harbor and the Panama Canal were America's biggest and most funded and most staffed overseas bases. There were 43,000 servicemen stationed on Oahu. Their median age was 19. They were divvied up between the Army, which was to defend Oahu from invading forces, and to protect the Navy while she was in port, and the Navy, which had one capital ship after another. At the time of the attack, there were 93 ships in the harbor. It was quite amazing, and in fact, they were so spectacular that Pearl Harbor itself was a tourist attraction.
So there were warnings internally in the War Department, as we knew it then, before it was the Defense Department, by June, for example, of 1940, warning of a possible raid there. How were those warnings handled?
Well, there are only two specific warnings about Hawaii. There were many vague warnings that, with 2020 hindsight, we look at them now and pull the needle out of the haystacks and pull all that together and go, why didn't they know there was this and this and this? But in fact, those circumstantial warnings that many people are excited about when they look into the Pearl Harbor documentation, those warnings were as serious, more serious for the Panama Canal than they were for Pearl Harbor.
All right. We'll understand a bit more about what led up to Pearl Harbor as we talk to Craig Nelson about his book, Pearl Harbor, From Infamy to Greatness, a new look at what led up to the events of December 7th, 1941. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange, and if you'd like to join us with your thoughts and impressions of Pearl Harbor and what it meant to the world, join us. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange with Craig Nelson and you in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Craig Nelson, not the actor, but the prolific author who tends to be drawn to momentous occasions and trends in American history. His latest book is called Pearl Harbor, From Infamy to Greatness, published in plenty of time for the 75th anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor, coming up next Wednesday, December 7th. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about what happened that day, but more importantly, as this book goes back in time, to look at the events that led up to that day. Join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Craig, I understand that even on Arizona's last voyage out of port that there were some signs of Japanese aggression. What happened out there?
Well, they were able to pick up some pings off the submarines, and you know, Lawson insists, you know, the sailor we've been talking about, insists that those were enemy submarines. But the Navy was sort of notorious for picking up errant stings, so we're not really sure if that's true. But there were two direct warnings about Pearl Harbor, and the stories are quite fascinating. The first one came in January 1941. When the ambassador to Tokyo for Peru warned the ambassador to Tokyo for the United States that he had heard from multiple sources that if things went south in the relationship between Tokyo and Washington, Pearl Harbor would be attacked. Now, the reason this is so interesting is because Peruvians then worked as cooks and servants and maids and gardeners and these kinds of things in Japan. So it very well might have been that this sort of underground network traveled from the Imperial Japanese Navy to the Peruvian ambassador to give him this warning, because in January they were just beginning the very first inklings of the plan that would become Operation Hawaii. But, of course, in America they said, oh no, the Japanese could never attack us. We're so powerful and mighty, and they couldn't possibly do such a thing, so forget that. But the second warning came in August 1941. And a fascinating character named Dusan Popov appeared in the offices of the FBI. Popov was a triple agent. He worked simultaneously for the intelligence services of the Yugoslavs, the British, and the Nazis. And he came to tell J. Edgar Hoover in August 1941 that he had been hired by the Nazis to assess American military capabilities, and that one-third of the assessment he was to do covered Pearl Harbor. But Hoover decided that he couldn't trust the word of a triple agent, even though the British had attested to Popov's bona fides, and that he didn't trust Popov because he knew the spy was having an affair with French actress Simone Simone, and that was illicit and terrible, and so you couldn't trust the word of someone like that. So that other warning was ignored.
Interesting. So who you knew or who you associated with could downgrade the quality of the intelligence in the eyes of the people potentially receiving it.
Uh-huh.
Wow, interesting. So let's go way back in time now, because Japan's war with Russia in 1905 laid some of the groundwork for what was to happen in 1941. How significant was that war between Japan and Russia?
Well, I really like backing up and showing a lot of background to this, because I thought it was fascinating to see the parallels between Japan's great naval victory, which was at a strait called Tsushima, where they were the first Asian nation to take down a European nation, and they just totally decimated the Russians in this fantastic maneuver called Crossing the T, where the Russians had their broadsides of their ships facing the Japanese, and the Japanese had the noses of their ships facing the Russians. So they were almost impregnable while they could just drop one ship after the next. And the reason why it was so interesting is because the same sort of surprise and the use of force and the sort of state-of-the-art technology used there would become a byword for the attack on Pearl Harbor, as well as the fact that the Japanese studied many, many things in planning their attack. They studied, in fact, a naval exercise that had taken place in the teens, where the United States Navy pretended to attack Pearl Harbor at dawn on a Saturday and was defended by the Army, and that defense failed. So they already, we know that they were paying attention to that. They also paid attention to an American naval aviator who patented a technique for loosing torpedoes in shallow water. And what he did was, he said you came in a spiraling dive to avoid counterstrike, and then you skimmed about 12 feet over the water, and then at about 1,500 yards before the target, you let loose your ordnance, and then immediately climb so you wouldn't crash into the target superstructure. And one of the aviators said that, "We knew we were flying too low when we dropped our torpedoes and the water hit our wings."
So this is an important thing, though, because the harbor at Pearl Harbor was believed to be, what, somewhat torpedo-proof because of how shallow it was, and that maneuver would have gotten around it?
Yeah, a normal torpedo needed around 70 feet of water to be dropped from a plane, pile down, get its propellant moving, stabilize itself, and run true to target. And the Pearl Harbor was about 35 to 50 feet deep. So Kimmel, the head of the Navy there, was convinced that torpedoes couldn't be used there, and he couldn't imagine that the Japanese would be able to send six aircraft carriers across all of the Pacific within 200 miles of his harbor and launch almost 400 planes from those decks, and all in secret, but they pulled it off. A lot of the comments we found in this research was the fact that, for example, one of my favorites is the head of Wheeler, which is one of the airfields that was destroyed, said, "How dare those yellow bastards do this to us when everyone knows America is superior to Japan." So you just had that attitude coming over and over again, and the one time Kimmel sort of let his guard down and let people know what he really felt was at a luncheon with his lawyer during one of the congressional invitations, when he said, "I just couldn't imagine they could do this to us."
Wow, a lot of not thinking about what the possibilities were. Craig Nelson's our guest. His book is Pearl Harbor, From Infamy to Greatness, here on the Jefferson Exchange. I want to come back a little further in history again, back in the general time of the aftermath of the Russo-Japanese War in 1905, because that brings in Admiral Yamamoto, and I learned a lot in your book about his experiences in and with the United States. How extensive were they?
Well, this is one of the great stories of history and something every historian loves, because Isoroku Yamamoto, whose name is 56 because his father was 56 at the time of his birth, and who lost two fingers in that Battle of Tsushima we were talking about, leading to Tokyo geishas calling him 80 sen because a manicure cost 100 sen, is probably the most written about man, a Japanese man in American history. He's a very complicated individual because for the entire year of 1941, he will simultaneously tell the Japanese that they're fools to want to go to war with America, and they're crazy to do it, and they can't do it, and they can't win that war, and they've got to stop themselves, and they can't do that war. But if they are going to go to war with America, they must attack Pearl Harbor, and they must decimate it, and they must take out that fleet, and they must sap American will to fight. And even though everyone tells him that they don't want to do this in the Navy, he threatens to quit two times, and it goes through. One of the fascinating things about him is the fact that he taught himself English by reading biographies of Lincoln. His great hero was Abraham Lincoln, and he spent many years in America traveling and staying in flop houses on his tiny military pay, and he really developed a taste for the country, but at the same time came up with this ludicrous idea that if he devastated American teenagers in Pearl Harbor, we would just say, oh, well, you can have Asia. What can we do about it? You win.
Well, that was the next question that I was going to ask, is how could somebody who liked American culture and understood it as well as he thought he did come up with this conclusion that we'd be demoralized by an attack rather than fired up by it?
It's insane. And, you know, just as insane was MacArthur sitting in the Philippines with 8 hours notice that Hawaii had been attacked. We had always thought the Philippines would be attacked, and he did absolutely nothing. And that's one of many mysteries that so far we don't have an answer to. And 75 years later, we don't have every question answered, which is fascinating to me.
Truly. Let's talk about some of the root causes here, though, of what would lead Japan to want to take on this war. And let's go back and talk about what the worldwide depression had done to Japan.
Well, there were basically two forces operating on the Japanese at once. One was the idea that it was sort of a takeoff on the Lebensraum idea that the Germans had, where they didn't have any natural resources. They were dependent on America for their 80% of their petroleum and 100% of their scrap metal, and they had to import everything. And if they had colonies, they would no longer have to import things, and they would be free to do what they wanted, and they wouldn't be crippled by the United States. And the United States knew this quite well. Roosevelt was inspired by a letter he received by an admiral. So they were sort of jerking the Japanese by the chain to get them to stop warring against the Chinese, who are our allies and very good friends of ours at the time, by restricting petroleum imports. So that was one side of the story. The other side of the story is that there was a tiny group of militant Japanese army officers who realized that they could cow the civilian government by threatening assassination and mob violence. They actually assassinated a number of the civilian prime ministers. So you have that part of the army sort of taking control of the government and manipulating everyone over to their point of view, using threats and actually killing civilian government leaders. And that group were the one who had invaded China and started what the Japanese call the Great East Asia War with that invasion of Manchuria. They then found themselves in what was essentially what America had in Vietnam. China was for Japan at that moment. It was this albatross and this mire that they could not win. There was no way they could win, but it was politically impossible to get out of as well. So they were trapped in China. The United States was furious that they were committing these war crimes against the Chinese, and their government was so chaotic that they changed hands 15 times in 14 years.
We're talking about Pearl Harbor, the anniversary, the 75th anniversary coming up next Wednesday, December 7th, the original attack, December 7th, 1941. Craig Nelson writes about it in Pearl Harbor, From Infamy to Greatness, and he goes back a long way in time to help us understand what led up to the attack on Pearl Harbor. You can join the conversation. You might have a few thoughts or memories of Pearl Harbor even. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Did the fact that World War I happened make people think that there could not be a second large conflagration? Was that part of the thinking of the world extant at the time?
Well, no. The effect of World War I on Americans is really incalculable, because even though we only had 400,000 men involved in that war, it had this unbelievably harsh effect, because so many of them came home. You know, it was an extremely brutal war with poison gas and terrible injuries. And you look at pictures of small town Depression America, and you will see, you know, one or two men who are in wheelchairs or have bandages around their eyes because they're blind or they're lame in some way or they're mentally disturbed. And those are all our World War One veterans who are in terrible condition. So the Americans, the great majority of American citizens, felt that the only thing, now with the rise of Hitler and Mussolini, they came to believe that the only thing World War One had benefited were arms manufacturers and European royalty, and that there was no purpose in getting involved again because it didn't have anything to do with us, and here we had made all this sacrifice and achieved nothing.
Well, and then we also didn't think very much of Japanese people as a race, apparently. There was a fairly common view, it seems, of Japanese people in the United States at that time.
Well, the Japanese were, the American citizens weren't really thinking about Japan as anything to worry about because it seemed far away. And even though we like the Chinese, especially the Sung sisters and Chiang Kai-shek, and there was sort of a glamorous group in Nanjing at the time, we were mad at the Japanese for doing that, but no one really thought they were a threat against the United States. And part of the reason they didn't was because we had this idea that they were physically inept and they didn't know how to do anything. And one of my favorite moments in the book is when a military intelligence officer appears at the War Department and does this presentation to all of the senior admirals about how the Japanese have better torpedoes than we do, a better fighter plane than we do. They have air crews that have spent 10 years with experience over China, whereas our air crews have very little flight time. And he's talking to them about how sophisticated, and one of the member of the audience starts laughing. And he goes, and everyone else starts laughing too. He goes, "What are you laughing about?" And they go, "You're talking about those funny little people."
Huh. And so that was the prevailing view. Amazing.
So that's why Pearl Harbor was such a surprise.
It is hard to you just mentioned Nanjing, and it's hard to reconcile the polite civil behavior of Japanese people within their own society with the atrocities committed at Nanjing and other places. Is there any good explanation for the barbarity shown in China?
Well, there's a bunch of theories. One of the biggest ones is the fact that, you know, there was a extravagant sort of racism going on where the Japanese saw themselves as very different from everyone else in Asia, that they were the natural overlords, and that they were justified in treating these subhuman people in any way they wanted. And you see it happening again and again. There's this fantastic tourist site outside of Kyoto called the Ear Mound, which is where, after they took over the Japanese had Korea as a colony at that time, and they got that colony by basically brutalizing the Koreans, and they brought home pieces of souvenirs, and the pileup of the burial of the souvenirs became the Ear Mound. So there was an entire history of the Japanese having this extremely harsh racist attitude towards everyone else in Asia.
So the United States, I think you mentioned sanctions already, had been taking some steps to try to curtail Japan's activity non-militarily. I mean, did any of it make much of a dent in Japan's march forward to what became Pearl Harbor?
Well, it was useful as a threat more than it was in actuality, because when you did it in actuality, then you were pushing them into a corner. And what happened was FDR wanted it as a threat, and he wanted it as sort of a noose hanging over their necks. He said he wanted to use it to prevent the wrong war in the wrong ocean at the wrong time, because he was very worried that the Nazi subcrews were taking down our shipping in the Atlantic, and in any minute they were going to take down a passenger ship. So there was this attitude of using it as a threat, but there were two guys, one in state and one in treasury, who went behind his back and turned it into a full embargo, using these two policies against each other, a freezing of Japanese funds and a licensing system for petroleum. And FDR was at an Argentia conference of Newfoundland with Churchill at the time, and he didn't find out about it for many, many months. And by the time he realized it, it was too late.
So as you mentioned, FDR referring to this as the wrong war, the wrong place at the wrong time, or wrong ocean, did American support of the European allies have an effect on preparations for Pearl Harbor? Can that case be made?
In 1940, when France fell, you saw a complete reversal of polls where Americans were finally ready to support the war effort. They had already been supporting it with the Lend-Lease and all of the various Roosevelt policies for aiding England, although the Congress wasn't supportive, the general population was. But then when France fell, people really started realizing that Europe was an issue and that we needed to do something. And around that time is when the draft begins and things start ramping up somewhat. But it takes a long time to get ready for war. And they had a year and a half, and that wasn't enough time.
Is there a particular conquest of territory that Japan made before Pearl Harbor that you think emboldened the Japanese enough to consider seriously, yes, let's do this with Pearl Harbor in the United States?
Well, what they did was they were going to launch this huge operation called Operation Number One, where they were going to take over all of Southeast Asia from the Russian border of Kamchatka in the northeast to the Indian border in the southwest. And they were going to do this. What had happened was the Nazis had told them after the fall of France that the Nazis weren't interested in Asia, so the Japanese started taking over parts of French Indochina. And they thought, well, now we'll finally have the oil we always wanted. You know, they kept taking over this territory and saying they were doing it to unify Asia, for Asians policy, and they're going to help create this fantastic economic stronghold, but they never were able to develop that.
Much more to talk about with Craig Nelson. His book is Pearl Harbor, From Infamy to Greatness, put out in time to coincide with the 75th anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor next Wednesday. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll come back with Craig Nelson and your phone calls and emails in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Craig Nelson, prolific author. His works tend to focus on momentous periods and events in American history, and he's done it again with a book called Pearl Harbor, From Infamy to Greatness, which observes much of the activity that led up to the Japanese attack on the United States on December 7th, 1941. 75 years ago, nearly to the day. You can join the conversation on the Exchange. Lots of people with lots of memories about Pearl Harbor and its aftermath still walk the earth. We hope to hear from you at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I was just reading that you had something like, between interviews and research, about 1 million pages of documents available to you. Was some of it, Craig, recently declassified or newly available?
Well, a lot of it was new material that people hadn't really looked at before, such as this moment when Roosevelt is at the laying of the keel. A great deal of it was new material that came out of Japan, since they were embarrassed by their history and only now are sort of looking at it with a certain amount of pride with respect. And a great deal of it is the fact that so many men and women were traumatized by their experience in World War II that they just couldn't talk about these things. And when you go through both interviews and oral history archives, you will see absolutely nothing in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. It's almost until the 90s and the aughts before anybody starts talking about this. So the previous books on Pearl Harbor seem to have a very sanitized approach. And when I originally read them, I thought, well, they're doing that because they're fearful of the feelings of their reader, that they don't want to do anything too gruesome. But then I realized they just didn't have this material available to them because the eyewitness accounts weren't ready to really go into depth and detail about this. I mean, one of the amazing discoveries to me, was realizing that because of the bombs and the torpedoes, all of these ships in the harbor were filled fuel. They were going to set sail on the 8th, on Monday the 8th. So they were all their tanks, fuel tanks, were full. And when they when they exploded all these things, it let loose 6-inch high oil film over this water, which ignited. So all these 16, 17-year-olds jumping off the exploding ships would jump into this flaming oil and turn into matchsticks. It was just a far more gruesome experience than it seems like anyone has really talked about before. And I think it's important to know these things so that when we have our boys coming home from wars now, and they're still young, just like they were at Pearl Harbor, and they have these traumatic experiences, we realize that it's not their fault.
Well, you know, it's, when you put it that way, it's useful to remember that when we send them away, they are barely out of boyhood.
And they're facing these incredible traumas that really they're not ready for. So I was glad to, even though it's some of it's gruesome and some of it's very hard to read and get through, I think it's time for people to be confronted with what war is really like.
The events of that day aside, I mean, how good was the intelligence that the countries involved had on each other? Was there, I mean, you mentioned earlier a few things that had come down the pike that in hindsight look like they might have meant something, but how much did Japan know about us in turn?
Well, Japan was very good with spy craft. They had spies all over our New York and California and Oregon cities measuring America's industrial might, and that measurements were sent back to Tokyo and ignored by the military there, while our spies and information was ignored by our military here. So it was just, you know, once leaders decide what they're going to do, they seem to ignore everything that stands in their way. And you can see it over and over and over again in this story.
Let's take a call from Vajra in Sunny Valley. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Craig Nelson.
Good morning. Thank you so much. Such an intelligent analysis. No propaganda, just real facts and really interesting. I had two uncles in Pearl Harbor, Leonard and Jim. They survived. And one of the things that a couple of points I wanted to make about prejudice and arrogance. My grandfather, my grandfather was German, had a German accent, and he had three sons in the military, and yet people ostracized him during World War II. So, and then the arrogance, the theme of arrogance that's going through the generals that you've quoted, and the not listening to the, you know, the capacities of the other side, you know, the enemy, so to speak, and that whole arrogance was really the weakness that made us vulnerable, or made the United States vulnerable. And I see that, we see that today in the Trump era, the Make America Great Again, the arrogance, the we're exceptional, and then the prejudice that is rising up, you know, all that hostility against people of other ethnicities, of various ethnicities. So I see a real theme, and can't we just learn from history?
Right.
I appreciate your book very much.
Good question.
Thank you. I couldn't agree more. And it's really a shame to see this glaring lesson where we repeatedly, you know, one of the amazing documents that we came across, which no one else seems to have looked at in this history, is that the Secretary of State, Cordell Hull, had 56 meetings with the Japanese ambassadors over the course of 1941. And he would keep these copious notes where he would write down everything that everyone said, or perhaps his secretary did that. But you can read him just abusing these ambassadors who are admirals and highly esteemed members of Japanese society, and he's just treating them like dirt. And you think, you know, the United States is so rich and so powerful and so successful. What happened to lèse-majesté? You know, why can't we treat people a little better than this? So that's what's always surprising to me.
Why did he take that attitude? Just because he was arrogant himself?
Because they thought they were disgusting little vermin people.
Wow.
This attitude about them was just like the Japanese held the Chinese. Many American leaders thought the Japanese were like vermin. So they would think of them as being this disgusting, horrible people you had to watch out for because they could take you over like insects. But they would also think that they weren't competent enough to do anything themselves. So they had to be allied with the Nazis to be able to achieve anything.
So certainly the standard question that comes up when we discuss Pearl Harbor is the big conspiracy one about whether FDR and people under him let Pearl Harbor happen because we needed some big event to kick us into World War II, in essence. Where do you come down on that?
Well, it was fantastic to go track down this whole ridiculous nonsense and to see how when someone's dead, you can really go after them and they're not around to defend themselves, so they can't do anything to stand up for themselves. Anyway, this entire ridiculous idea started with one of the founders of the America First Committee, which many of you may remember was the ultra hard right, anti Roosevelt, anti military, anti globalist, anti everything operation. It was the one that Charles Lindbergh got in so much trouble with his anti Semitic comments and his military accolades from the Nazis. And one of the founders of that committee began the entire "Oh, Roosevelt must have been involved" bit right after Pearl Harbor in 44. And then it gets picked up by one of Kimmel's lawyers, who worked with the head of the Navy in Hawaii during one of his congressional investigations. One of his lawyers picks it up. It's then expanded by a guy who wants to take all the blame off the Navy and pin it on the civilian government. And you actually can watch this campaign develop, dragging Roosevelt in. The reason that it's so crazy is because no one loved the United States Navy more than Franklin Roosevelt. And if he was going to do any kind of scheme like this, it would not involve the Navy, number one. Number two, we were being dragged into World War II at any minute, and the Nazi subs were taking down one ship after the next. They were doing it so close to the shore that people could watch from the shore as their oil tankers exploded off the coast of Louisiana and New York and Florida. And at any minute, they were going to take down a American passenger vessel. The American public was already on the side of doing something. They realized with the fall of France that soon it was only going to be us and the British and the Soviets, and pretty soon the British might go, and then it was going to be only us. And finally, you have a situation where, for 2 years, the Army and the Navy told Roosevelt that Hawaii is a bastion of power in the Pacific. We have 43,000 servicemen. Japan would never dare attack us. It's the Gibraltar of the Pacific. It's impregnable fortress. And then on November 5th, 1941, barely a month before the attack, they go, you know what? We've been wrong. Actually, Japan is much more powerful than us in the Pacific, and you've got to play for time. And all of the sort of belligerence and hostility that the negotiations have been carried on suddenly vanish, and you watch Roosevelt do everything he possibly can. The only one is his administration doing everything he can to calm things down with Japan, even to the point of writing a letter over the heads of his own State Department and Japan's Foreign Office directly to Hirohito.
So, and then on the other side, the negotiations and discussions going on inside the Japanese government are well portrayed. You write of a liaison conference in Japan on November 1st, 1941, which, in your words, is one of the most controversial moments in Japanese political history. What happened?
It lasted for, I think, 17 hours, and it was the final decision to go to war against the United States. And it starts off with all of the Navy and Hirohito and many people against this war. And Hirohito even quotes his revered grandfather, the Emperor Meiji, about why does there need to be war. And it's quite an amazing moment, because you literally see a government that has lost its mind and can be sort of tweaked into different directions depending on who's the staunchest character at the table. It's a very frightening moment when you see how, because you have again and again people from, you have the spies in New York writing back to Tokyo, whatever you do, don't go to battle against the United States. You have the entire Navy saying, whatever you do, do not go to war against the United States. I mean, the firmness against this was so strong, and it just topples like little pins in the breeze.
So outside that room, how much did the Japanese public know? How much did the Japanese public want war or not?
It was a very top-down society, and what they thought didn't really matter to anyone. There was a sort of difference of rank between who was running the country and everyone else. It was that was one of the great of MacArthur's changes in society, was bringing democracy and republicanism to Japan, and the common people loved it.
2 weeks after this liaison conference in Japan, November 1st, where the decision to go to war is made, in the United States, General Marshall holds an off-the-record press conference. How likely did war appear to the United States at that time?
This was an amazing, amazing moment. So one of the great things about this story to me is you get to watch both MacArthur and Marshall start off, and they're not really so good at their jobs, okay? They make a lot of mistakes, and of course, in the end, Marshall is going to be the first professional soldier in history to win the Nobel Peace Prize. But in 1941, in November, he decides to hold a secret press conference with all of the major press people, the wire services, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and he brings them in to talk about how war is going to come soon, but it doesn't matter because the United States is going to be ready. There's a danger period the first week of December, but after that, we're going to be so together, it's going to be just fine because we're going to have B-17s taking off in the Philippines, bombing the Japanese home island, and coming back home. And one of the reporters points out that, well, according to your specs, the B-17 doesn't have the range to get from the Philippines to Japan and back. And afterwards, the New York Times sums up this meeting in an article called "This is a War We Could Lose."
Wow. And interesting to think about news media in another context. As you point out, the Honolulu Advertiser's presses broke on December 6th. What was supposed to be the front page?
How peace was great and there was no problem with Japan. That's a good story, isn't it?
It really is.
The other great press story is that Roosevelt gets a hold of everyone through his press office after the attack and tells them that if they really talk about how terrible things are, it will only boost the enemy and suppress morale in the United States. And they go along with it. So if you look at the front pages that come out after the attack, everyone says 300 die on Oahu. And you know, the CBS local affiliate knew that it was a lot more than that, but they followed what the government wanted to do.
So back to the conspiracy theory that you've already shot large holes in. You take this up again in the back of the book with some references to conspiracy theories in general in America. Why do you suppose they have such a powerful hold to this day?
Well, there's a fantastic new social study called Conspiracism, and it tries to analyze why psychologically and socially people like this. And it's basically that it's a lot more comforting to think that there are these puppet masters at the CIA arranging with mobsters to kill Kennedy instead of the fact that a crazy person with a gun can take down a president and change the course of history. But in fact, in this book, there are many moments when one individual can do everything. There's an incredible guy named Tomita, who's the corporal, the army corporal in charge of the Tokyo Cable Office. And this one guy delays Roosevelt's cable to Hirohito and Tokyo's cable to Washington announcing the end of negotiations. So basically, the entire giant history of infamy is based on this one character.
Oh, because there can be weak links in the chain, so instead of puppets, you get individual actors.
Right.
Wow, amazing stuff. The book is called Pearl Harbor, From Infamy to Greatness. Craig Nelson wrote it. Craig, I really enjoyed talking to you today. Thanks for coming.
It was terrific.
All right, take it easy.